Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tate Modern. My name is Marco Daniel, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here for this afternoon's Talking Art series. My colleague Patricia is going to talk a little bit more now about this afternoon's speakers. I just wanted to welcome you all, as I say, and remind you that this is part of an ongoing series of artists' conversations that we have here, mostly on Saturday afternoons in the Star Auditorium.
Good afternoon. My name is Patricia Bickers. I'm editor of Art Monthly, and this is the latest in a collaborative series we're doing with Tate Modern called Talking Art, partly to celebrate the publication of our book, 30 Years of Interviews. And on your seats there's a leaflet for the forthcoming talks, so please do consult it. We're very proud this afternoon to have the conversation between Gustav Metzger and Andrew Wilson. Gustav Metzger really doesn't need much introduction, but just in case, you probably know him as an artist and political activist who developed the concept of autodestructive art and co-organized the Destruction in Art Symposium in London way back in 1966. He is, of course, a pioneer of environmental issues in art, and he famously declared an art strike in 1977 to 1980, but that didn't mean that he wasn't personally active. And it is only now, in fact, that some of his pioneering projects are actually being realized. Famously, the Project Stockholm, which is related to the one you've been seeing on screen, which was originally conceived in 1972 for the UN Environmental Conference in Stockholm, and has now been produced for the Sharjah Biennale. But some of you may, I hope, have seen his project for Münster last year, which for me was the standout project of all of them. We're very proud, too, that he'll be talking to Andrew Wilson, who is, of course, a curator of modern and contemporary art at Tate, but who was formerly deputy editor of Art Monthly and who is a contributor whenever I can tie him down. So welcome and thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Patricia. Marco, can we have a little bit more? Thank you.
They've got that light in the middle.
Could we have the light? Thank you. Thanks. Great. I'm very, very pleased to be in conversation with Gustav today. It's very personally very, very, very happy to be doing it because we've known each other now for, I imagine, 25 years, and I find it quite overwhelming that the first time that we met, and I organised a lecture demonstration at Sussex University in 1983, to which seven people turned up, and to be in a room with as many of all of you here, I think stands as some testament to the significance of Gustav's work and his the force of his continuing ideas. Now, in that intervening period, Gustav has been incredibly active, and since he, as it were, settled back in Britain in the early 90s, after a long period of moving around Europe, he has been making a large amount of work, both reconstructions of old work and new work, and realizing old ideas in a new way. And there have been a series of exhibitions that have been, as it were, development that have changed the place in which people have understood Gustav's work. Retrospectives of the Museum of Modern Art in Oxford, and at Vienna at the Generali Foundation, but also smaller surveys in Lund, in Warsaw, the Sharjah Biennale piece, which was, in a sense, does stand out because though Gustav is known very much in terms of autodestructive art and his ideas about autodestructive art and the developing theories of it, what the piece for Shoshar, I think, shows is that his ideas are concerned not so much with destruction, and we're going to talk about this a bit later, I hope, and discuss it, but a much more positive than an idea of destruction might at first suggest. And the work at Sharjah, as Patricia was saying, was first planned and proposed for the first United Nations Environmental Conference in Stockholm. Didn't happen. And a smaller version of it was proposed for the Document 5 the same year, which also, for one reason or another, didn't happen. And it is only now, last year, that one part of that work was realised for Sharjah. And why it's so important is that it stands as a sort of beacon, a way of understanding that one of the important aspects of Gustav's work over the last 10 years that he's been developing, certainly since he's been back in London, has been very much with ecological issues and issues to do with the environment. And the fact that that was a very important part of the original theories of autodestructive art that were developed in the late 50s and early 60s. So my first question, actually, though, is not so much about environmental issues and ecology, because we are going to come back and discuss that at some length a bit later. But to ask, first of all, over the last 10 years, you have been working on these many exhibitions, and a large number of them have involved old work and new work. And the old work is actually new work because they're reconstructions, because this is work that has never survived and was never meant to have survived. I just wonder if you see anything, a paradox emerging in the fact that you are remaking work in this way and what that means to you.
Can I just add that the film we saw, this film, is Sharjah, since we didn't have captions,
yeah.
The film we saw is Sharjah Biennale, last spring, summer, and it consisted of 100 cars grouped around a kind of tent, a kind of plastic-covered structure. And in the first week of the Biennale, the cars were pumping, were running, motors running, and the exhaust was let into that covered structure. I think we just make that explanation. And it is a remake on a large scale of a model, which was made for an exhibition at Gallery House, London, in the spring of 72. The model was displayed, 120 cars, and the project was outlined in that exhibition and in the Documenta 5 catalogue. And so, to answer your question, what is it? It is a reconstruction of a model, but on a large scale, on one-to-one scale, decades later, and it's a new work. So the answer is it is quite complex, but it can be explained as in coherent manner along these lines.
I do feel that the meaning of the work changes materially in its remaking. I mean, the context will almost demand that, perhaps.
Yes, originally meant for Stockholm, Sweden. It's now was made in a very hot climate under completely different political conditions than had it been made in originally, had it ever been made for Sweden. But in actual fact, it was never attempted to be made in Sweden. It was hooked on to a Swedish context, Swedish international context.
And this is one part of a two-part work that's... So would you like to explain?
It would probably... I don't think we need to go into any great details, except summing it up. The second part of this project would be that the cars would be moved into the interior of the structure and would eventually be blown apart one way or another.
So, I think it would be useful to go back in time. I think right now the 1950s, because you are one of a group of artists from that time who turned away from traditional ways of making art at the end of the 50s and the beginning of the 60s. And evolved new languages of how art could be made, new ways of making art, an art that would abolish boundaries between disciplines and activities, an art that would be more about process or event rather than object. And it's also an art that has inscribed in it a very much a social or political function as an action. I mean, you famously, the first lines of the lecture you gave to the Architectural Association, which in a sense codifies the theory of autodestructive art, you gave in 1965. You talk about it as being a coherent theory of action. Before we talk a bit about this sense of making an art of this character, which is also has inscribed that. Excuse me, could you please turn the light off? Thanks. Before we talk more about how your art is embodies an idea of political or social action within it, I just wonder if you can maybe give an account of how these changes take place. Because in 1958, you were living in Norfolk, in King's Lynn, and you became involved in direct action against the nuclear and against the American rocket bases nearby in Swaffham. You then, the following year, moved to London and started to evolve your ideas of autodestructive art, having effectively been a painter beforehand, before that time. And in 1960, while you're evolving your ideas of autodestructive art, you become a founding member of the Committee of 100, which is a body of dedicated, as it were, to direct action against nuclear power, nuclear war. And I just wonder, what is it that made you effect these changes, not only within your work, but in the way you led your life as part of your work?
I think that goes back to the early stages of my actual involvement with art. I felt that art could be a force for change, for social change, and of course it is. That is the case. And so the idea of linking art, thinking about art, making art, and social realities was present at the age of 18 when I moved into the idea of working in art. So it goes back decades before I was going towards an art that would directly interact with society, hopefully for the better.
And what made you decide to be an artist in that sense? I mean, that you made that conscious decision that you wanted to be an artist and also that should involve some sort of social action as well.
Yes, well, before that, I was concerned with social change as such, and I thought one could be active in politics, in revolutionary politics, in order to effect social change. So there was this gradual movement towards, and at that, around that time of involvement with politics, I was also reading, among others, the writings of Eric Gill, who was an artist, a Catholic, and very concerned, a socialist, very concerned with society. And he had a quote which I more or less remember. The artist is not a peculiar kind of man. Every man is a peculiar kind of artist, which of course is a forerunner of famous Boyce quote. So you see, from the age of 16, 17, I was involved, not just with the possibility of politics, but of course with art, and particularly with craft, which I was working as a furniture maker. I studied furniture making, and so I was to build, in a sense, but also to work, to workers.
Yeah. So was that, did you see yourself also in any sense as part of an art and crafts tradition? Or were you thinking of, did you know of, read about William Morris as well, for instance? Mm.
It must have cropped up through Gill. If you read Gill, he's so directly involved with it earlier. And most of the arts and crafts people were, in fact, socialists or communists, kind of communists. So it goes back very far. It isn't that sudden I get involved with nuclear disarmament. It's a fairly logical step from the early phases of my life.
But then the step from making paintings with paint on canvas or board to evolving an idea of art that might be auto-destructive, that is quite a big step, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, that's right. Yes, and a very difficult, extremely, in a sense, painful, wrenching experience.
What led you to make that move, have that wrenching experience?
I think that directly relates to history. The war, of course, when I started thinking of being active in social change, the war period, when I was 17, 16, 18, was a major experience, moving me into the future. And when it comes to the atom explosions, the whole world was totally shaken up, and no doubt I was too. And that is another step, I think, towards the idea of interacting with society, hopefully for the better.
I mean, and also that does refer back to your early life as well, and your move from Germany to Britain just before the war started.
Yes,
and the fact that your family was lost in the Holocaust.
Large part in Poland or thereabouts. But to come back to art, when I got involved with art, I was very concerned with modern art, and very soon concentrating on avant-garde, and of course we've got this wonderful show ending tomorrow of the avant-garde at the British Library, that major exhibition. And with that kind of direction, I was almost immediately, certainly coming to London in the end of 1945, I immediately got involved with avant-garde art. And avant-garde art is at the center, the desire and the need to go beyond the existing. And so ever since starting as an artist, after a year or so of starting, I was feeling my way towards a point where I could break with the past, in a sense, where I could on the past into something. And so that it happened at a certain point in the autumn of 1959 in London, again having been away for a 5 or 6 years. It came sort of coming back, I think, with another kind of energy and an openness to change within a great metropolis.
So from 1959, you evolved this theory of autodestructive art. You published a number of 5 manifestos that have shifting emphases within what are probably fair to describe 3 principles underlying autodestructive art, that it was an art that was concerned with, as a reaction to the nuclear threat. It was an art that was concerned and reacted to and dealt with an ecological and environmental threat, and it was also an art that was an attack on the art market and on the capitalist system as a whole. You also described the resulting works of autodestructive art, perhaps paradoxically, as monuments, as public art, and that these were monuments, pharaonic monuments, I think you described them as, to our own capacity for destruction. Now, if we think about that is often the case that destruction can often be thought of as negative, having negative overtones. It's iconoclastic or destructive. But autodestructive art doesn't necessarily have that overtone at all, that thrust of meaning, does it? I mean, it's much more, in a sense, it's positive. I just wonder if you'd like to talk a bit about that and how these ideas come together.
Yes. So many different planes. And I accept the way you presented it. And I that is actually the point. What I was after is the comprehension, the bringing together of actual social and intellectual and artistic aesthetic realities into one formula, into one hope. That was the aim. And from the first manifestos, 3 manifestos, autodestructive, published between 1959 and 61, they concentrate these directions. And then you referred to the lecture at the AA in 1965, which is a summary of the experience that I had and an attempt to present it in a comprehensive manner. And that is an attempt to respond to actuality. Contemporary life then and now is extremely complex. It's full of interactions. And so this was an attempt comprehend large chunks of the world within a theory and a framework of ideas and practice. Now, the problem, my problem, and it's ongoing, is that the monuments that are at the center of the theory were never made, and there is no prospect of them being made, or they could be made. And these monuments would, in fact, be large. They would be in public sphere, and they would disintegrate bit by bit in a time not more than, say, 20 years. They would then be gone. The monuments would not survive more than 10, 20 years. All that is a kind of shock, horror shock. My God, what's happened? But it hasn't happened. And so there's a theory which aims to change the world, but it's never had the opportunity for interacting, testing, except in talk.
Do you feel frustrated that the monuments haven't been built so they can fall apart?
It is
could you maybe define a bit more how you understand the idea of public art in this sense? I mean, because you do see these as public art. They're not for individual consumption. They're for they serve a collective purpose, in a sense, don't
yes,
they?
That again goes back to my reading at the age of 16, 17, and 18, Gill and others, yeah, that art is for the public. And the public interacts with the art without paying, without formalities. And that is an ideal of art that goes back thousands of years. And so I was in that tradition, a normal tradition of making for the public, in the public sphere.
So how happens? As part of that, part of this, you also, quite obviously, autodestructive art doesn't deliver commodities that can be traded. And so you were attacking the art market in that point. You also wanted to use that as a microcosm.
That's right. As I said, the theory is on planes, and this is a very important plane, that art is not meant to be traded and bartered, and certainly not in the manner that we are used to now in the past decades, and especially now. There was a recent article I came across in the Herald Tribune discussing a work by John, and it's his painting started at $1 million and recently was sold for $88 million. Well, I don't think that's the way art should be treated.
So what's your solution to this? Do you have a solution to your own mind to the way the market works?
Yes, as you know, in the catalogue, the ICA catalogue, Art into Society, I proposed what is now called the art strike. And I still, after all these years, or especially after these years, in view of the present developments in the art world, I do believe the turning down of the art gallery system is an essential path in the development of contemporary art. I think we are getting bored with these auction results. We are bored with picking up an art magazine which is 80% advertisement. And we are becoming more intelligent in a sense. And so I believe the time is ripe for the disbandment of the art galleries, and I would vote for that. I think art galleries, and I exclude, of course, institutions like this, public galleries. Yes, I do. I'm speaking of the commercial galleries and auction houses, which function to artificially and through all kinds of devious machinations to crazy results. I think these two institutions, these general institutions, can be attacked intellectually and historically and certainly morally. And I believe the time is ripe for artists to take power into their hands and readjust the whole system so we do not have art gallery, except, of course, if some individual is desperate to have an art gallery, we won't, you know, say, right, you know, you mustn't. But in general, can phase them out. They can be phased out as from now, at any time. And I believe that art will flourish as a consequence. Artists will exhibit as groups, yes, and work with institutions such as this. That's my feeling now. I haven't given up this idea of tearing down the art system through the action of artists. And of course, when we speak the action of artists, we include curators and art historians, and the whole field of art activity can come together. And I wouldn't use the word Renaissance, but we can certainly reconstruct, recreate, and advance the essential spirit, the essential necessities of art.
I mean, there is a sense maybe that the reaction or what happened when we first met, and I organised this lecture demonstration in 1983 that seven people went to. And only seven people went because your name at that point was not in the history books, or it was there but in little references, because there could perhaps maybe be a sense to which the history books are largely written by the objects that are traded on through the marketplace. Would you agree with that to a certain extent?
I haven't quite got that.
That the history of art, yes, is almost constructed as a result of those objects that are traded through the marketplace, yes, and yes, you didn't make objects that could be traded in the usual, yes, way of things.
Yes, and complexity of the theory. The theory is complex, and at that point it was difficult to get hold of. There are now, the manifestos are reprinted, for example, in the Christine Stiles compendium on artist writings, and all that of course helps. For example, towards the exhibitions that you were just mentioning that have happened in the past 10 years, the literature has built up bit by bit.
So if we turn to another aspect of autodestructive arts, you are known in terms, when you are known in terms of autodestructive art, and this event, the Destruction in Art Symposium in 1966, but by that time, certainly from about 1965, your interests were shifting somewhat, weren't they?
Yes.
Towards a concern with science and a concern with technology and what its effects might be or were. And you're involved with organisations like the British Society for Social Responsibility in Science, as well as the Computer Arts Society and so forth. I was just wondering if you could perhaps describe a bit how you understood this change that your work and your interests were undergoing at that time.
Yes, it is not difficult. It was on the basis of a very, very deep experience that I went through in the beginning of 1965, when I realized that the science and technology is not accidental. It doesn't come about by chance or merely through historical accumulation through in periods of time. I sensed and I tried to understand that within the actual science, and science is always generally linked with technology, with telescopes, with machinery, with optics. All this activity, I sensed, had to do with destructive elements in the human being, in the individual human being and in groups. And I felt one needs to uncover this if you're going to get out of the direction like endlessly building armies and atomic bombs and other weapons. So 10 years, 65, 75 were essentially in my inner understanding concerned with such questions. And again, that of course links with autodestructive art. Autodestructive art is destructive and leads you to think about destruction. And so it is in the
art. It leads you to think about every aspect of your life almost, what its effects might be, the effect of any decision, the fact that some scientific process, for instance, might have a fairly mundane, or seem fairly mundane, but could have devastating effects when applied in other contexts or in other ways. So, I think if what also ran counter to this, though, was that, or parallel rather with this period and your increased interest in science, is what you have talked retrospectively. You described this period as a political phase, and I just wonder what could be more political than the the work you had been doing in the early 60s with the Committee of 100 and the way that interfaced with your art. What made your activities in the early 70s leading up to the declaration of the Years Without Art in 1974, which to happen in between 77 and 80, what makes that more political?
Can I just go back to the 60s and say something about the other side of this quest in trying to understand the development of science and technology through history, was the clear vision that we need to transform the kind of science and technology that we've got. There are two strands. One is the attempt, in my mind, to discover, to uncover, and to research how science and technology got to the stage up to, say, the atom bomb, with destructive energies going through individual physicists, for example, whether it's Einstein or Niels Bohr, physicists in particular, but other scientists, are within themselves destructive. And so they move in directions that will end in destruction through physics or through biology or through chemistry and whatever this range. So at the same time as exploring that, the vision of a science which goes the other way, which uses nature, which engages with water and waves, what we are now talking about. And there is the article published in Studio International in two parts, Automa and History. And the first part ends along the lines that we can move into the technology of paradise, i.e., living, as primitive people do, surrounded by nature, using nature and the sun to survive. So I think that is the point, which later on leads me to write this essay in 1999, which is so subtitled, Damaged Nature.